So one of the gentlemen that I mentioned last week, Marcellus Williams, was indeed executed by the state of Missouri, again, for a crime that he did not commit, and there was no evidence, no physical evidence connecting him to the crime. There was DNA on the murder weapon, but it wasn't his. And yet, the state was insistent on executing this man. I guess because this strong belief in the principle of capital punishment. And that's something, a topic that we can deal with at another time, but really just connects me to where I left off. And that was a surprise last week. I said, need more time. I didn't think I'd get more time this week already, but here we are. So that kind of connects us to where we left off last week, in that we were talking about, in our question of where is the love, we were talking about where is the love for the innocent. And Mr. Williams, by all evidence, was indeed innocent. Another aspect that of shedding innocent blood, and again, that was considered a very serious sin and very serious offense in the Old Testament, and evidence of the king's wickedness, evidence that his throne was about, it was a throne of sin, was because he shed innocent blood. So another aspect of shedding innocent blood that we often talk about, that is a topic of very frequent discussion in our society, is that of abortion. Big political issue, big issue in the church, and something that is very, a topic that's very, very divisive. And this is brought up as a topic, as an example of shedding innocent blood. And that's a D, where's the love for innocent? D in the outline. The unborn is innocence. And the scripture, the Old Testament scripture that's most frequently cited with regard to that topic is Genesis 9 and 6, which says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. Now, there are some who say that this verse says, whoever sheds man's blood within man, by blood his blood should be shed, which is being used to tie that to abortion. And I chose to research that. I went through every version and translation of the Bible that that is referenced in Bible Gateway, and I also posed the question to a Bible scholar and a Hebrew scholar as we had dinner last Sunday, and his indication was that he didn't see any indication that it is man within man. His indication was that it means and reads the killing of another person. So not man within man, but shedding of man's blood. So another Old Testament scripture that deals with this is found in Exodus 21, verses 22 and 23. That reads, if men fight and hurt a woman with child, that's a woman who's pregnant, so she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him. And he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Interestingly enough, that's one of those references where we get that principle of an eye for an eye. So in this passage, if the men were fighting, the harm to the child was not, apparently not the primary thing, but if it was if the wife got harmed, then they had a problem. And then apparently that person's life was required of them. So interesting treatment of that. The New Testament doesn't seem to address this issue squarely. And I know that I had heard in some venues something I thought was pretty absurd. And that statement was that in Judaism, in some cases, abortion is actually not only prescribed but required. I said, that sounds crazy to me. So let me see. Let me do some research on this and see what, go to some Jewish sources to see what they had to say about it. And I'm just going to read this excerpt from this article, the source being My Jewish Learning. It says, most American Jews strongly support legalized abortion. A 2015 Pew Research Forum survey said that 83% of American Jews, more than any other religious group, say abortion should be legal in almost cases. However, Judaism position, so we're not saying that all Jews say or support abortion. Judaism's position on abortion is nuanced, and both principal camps in the American debate over abortion rights can claim support for Jewish texts. And they were trying to answer the question, is Judaism pro-choice or pro-life? And I'll share these articles with anybody who's interested. But just to summarize, what the question came down to is, aside from the Genesis 9:6 treatment and the Exodus treatment, is that, one, there's disagreement with what's commonly said of life began at conception. Generally, Judaism does not look at it that way. And indeed, as we shared before, biologically, conception is something different than what we in our political discourse say it is, because the fertilization of the egg biologically is not conception. It is not until that fertilized egg attaches itself to the wall of the uterus that is the point of conception biologically. And we also know that the vast majority of fertilized eggs pass out of the body without attaching to that uterine wall. So that's just biology. But anyway, so what the general Jewish position from these sources, and I took sources from conservative and liberal Jewish sources, was that the point of humanity where there's accountability for the life of that being is at birth. When as soon as the head or whatever part of the fetus's body starts to come out of the body, then that's the point at which it has personhood. And again, I'll share these sources with you. But in any case, I was trying to answer the question, well, how in the world can the Jews say that abortion can be in some cases required? So here's the deal. Judaism does not allow you to take a life to save a life. But that being that's growing, that fetus that's growing inside you, as a woman has full personhood. But until that fetus starts to come out of the body, it does not have full personhood. So they look at it as if it if it's a situation in which giving birth threatens the woman's life, then the most extreme of them say, well, that's this fetus is trying to kill the mother. And so we have, as a to prevent the mother from being killed, then we have to we have to take care of that through termination of the pregnancy. Bottom line, my research, although I thought it was kind of absurd that the belief that they would say that, indeed my research did confirm that that was a general consensus with that. Now, there's some other, again, I'll share these sources with you. There are some other considerations that I'd like to talk about that are practical considerations, because I saw something a couple of weeks ago that, let me just say, was thought-provoking. We were driving along, I can't remember, it might have been Hickory Road, one of those roads in Indiana, coming from the Osceola area toward Mishawaka, and past the cemetery. There was a monument about this tall. And on that monument, it said, the inscription on the monument had this beautiful heart and a ribbon, and it said, in memory of the unborn. In memory of the unborn. So I started to think about that. Well, do we have a case here in which these unborn are innocents that have been slain? And the question was, well, what, if this is in memory of the unborn, well, what do you remember about the unborn? What do they remember about the unborn? Was there a particular way they laughed or smiled, or, you know, a particular characteristic of that being that to remember? When I look over here at this space here at the end, I remember Bill Salmon sitting there, and I remember Maylene sitting there, and I remember the way that he would sing, and I remember the way that they would be together. You know, I remember, I'll go way back, I remember Othel and Mary Thane. I remember Gail Rigglesworth and her family, and I remember her voice and how she sang. When I think about my daughter Angela, Angela was, she was a couple cars shorter before Deck. I'm just going to tell you that, frankly, about my daughter. But she was just the most zany character. She had a terrible, she had this funny sense of humor. She had this word that she liked to use if something wasn't right. She liked to use the word unacceptable. That's unacceptable. And she was so able, so willing to go to bat for somebody, to fight something that she thought was wrong. I remember this time that she had to speak with the water company up in Beecher, and my daughter got a hammer and went up to the city office to threaten the people over this water bill. I remember all these things about Angela, but I can't. What could I possibly remember about somebody who had not been born? So to me, that's the extreme of which this conversation has gone to. And I want to give you one more piece of history on that, and then I'm going to be through with that particular topic, and this will be short. But interestingly enough, historically, that topic was not a big deal in evangelical circles. If you go back to the 1950s, early 60s, it was looked at as a Catholic issue, something for them to deal with. As evidence of that, I would submit to you, and this was another thing I read, and I thought, this is really crazy what this guy is saying. So I need to research this. But the headline that I thought was so absurd that I wanted to research because I didn't believe what he was saying, he said the abortion issue was never about protecting life. it wasn't even originally about abortion. It was about preserving segregation. Absurd. So I decided I would research this gentleman named Andrew Workman. So one of the things that he said was that in the 60s, said that there was something that was a conference that was sponsored by Christianity Today. Anybody heard of Christianity Today? Anybody seen Christianity Today? Anybody read Christianity Today? Okay, well, he said that Christianity Today and the Christian Medical Society had a conference in 1968 that was all about this issue. And in my research, I confirmed that it was called the Symposium on the Control of Human Reproduction. It took place in August, about this time of year, August 27th through 31st in 1968. And so what they concluded was that they refused to classify abortion as sinful. It said that individual health, family welfare, and social responsibility were suitable justifications for ending a pregnancy. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that that should be our authority, what somebody at a conference said. Don't get it twisted. I'm not saying that just because they said that that's what we should believe. That's not what I'm saying. All I'm saying is that's what the position of Christianity Today, and again, its editors and this conference was at the time. In fact, when they handed down that decision, the then pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, anybody heard of First Baptist in Dallas? It's pretty prominent right now in the political discourse because of their pastor is Robert Jeffress. You ever heard that name, Robert Jeffress? Very, very engaged in our politics, and I will not say anything more than that. But this was one of his predecessors at that church, and he was president at the time of the Southern Baptist Convention. His statement says, "I've always felt that it was only after a child was born and had a life separate from its mother that it became an individual person," Criswell said, "and it has always therefore seemed to me that what is best for the mother and the future should be allowed." Interesting. And again, I am not advocating that we should take and adopt our doctrine and our beliefs from what a Baptist preacher said. It's not what I'm saying, but what is interesting is that what he said is consistent, at least in some aspects, with the Jewish view that personhood begins at birth. And we'll leave it at that. So, the original absurd question about it being in segregation, I have some information on that that I will not present here, but if you're interested in seeing it, I have those articles that I'm more than willing to share. There's another aspect of this. Moving on, the next question in your outline is, where is the love for women? In Ephesians 5, we as men are told that we ought to love our wives. Let me read some of that to you. Ephesians 5, began at verse 25. "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church." True confession, brothers. And I'm not pointing fingers at anybody here because I would have four fingers pointed back at me. But I'm appalled at how sometimes we,
talk to our wives. It's my belief that at times, and I'm talking to me now, so you have to, you judge yourself, you examine yourself and find out whether this is true for you. But sometimes the way that I talk to my wife isn't loving. It's not respectful. It doesn't have the hallmark of somebody who's loving her as me. It doesn't have the hallmark of loving her like I love my own body. Definitely doesn't have the hallmark of being willing to sacrifice myself for her like Christ sacrificed himself for the church.
I'm talking about me. You judge for yourselves, brothers, whether that applies to you. So I don't talk to my wife right. So I'll leave it at that. But at the same time, this principle, if we are to love our own wives, our own selves, and be willing to give ourselves for her as Christ loved the church, then as it pertains to this earlier topic that I was discussing, telling my wife that she has to give birth when there's a high likelihood or possibility that she would not survive that birth doesn't to me appear in any sense to be in conformance with what this is, where I should be willing to sacrifice my life for my wife. But that's me asking her to sacrifice her life for me and this as yet unborn child. Judge for yourself whether that makes sense and whether that's consistent with what we're being taught here as to how we're supposed to treat our wives and how we're supposed to love our wives. Finally, run out of time. No extensions on this one. Where is our love for the truth? You know, sometimes truth hurts. Sometimes truth digs a little bit, especially if we've been over here out in left field dealing in falsehood, dealing in lies, dealing in misinformation. Where's our love for the truth? In 2 Thessalonians, we read about a lawless one. And before we go there, I'm not necessarily saying that there's any application, direct application to anything we have going on right now. But if the second coming of Christ has not happened and he hasn't gathered all the church, then And I'm not talking about rapture. John has explained to us very thoroughly and very capably about that concept. But this seems to be still, at the time that this book was written, some future situation. And in verse 9, it talks about a lawless one coming with power and signs and lying wonders. Let me read that real quick. Beginning at verse 9, 2 Thessalonians 2. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Verse 10, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. So from this we know that they're talking about the gospel. They didn't want to hear the gospel to be saved. Verse 11, and for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they may be condemned who do not believe the truth, but have pleasure in unrighteousness. Are we listening and believing to a lie? Whether it's regarding the scripture, whether it's regarding our salvation, whether it's regarding our life in this world. Are we taking in information that is causing us to believe things that are untrue? Are we amplifying and repeating things that are untrue? Understand that there's consequences for those things, which is presented in verse 12. They all might be condemned who do not believe the truth, but have pleasure in unrighteousness. Where's the love for the truth? So in conclusion, where's the love? In 1 John 4, we have some commands there. It said, beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. Was anybody at the singing? Everybody who was at the singing in Niles, remember that song that I tried to teach? These are some of the lyrics of that song. These are the lyrics of that song. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. We're commanded to love one another. We're also, because of that command, that's the real test for whether God's even in us. Verse 12, no one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us and his love has been perfected in us. By this we know that we abide in him and he in us because he has given us of his spirit. Interesting. I used to be part of a congregation that said you had to vote a certain way or a certain candidate, otherwise you weren't a real Christian. This is telling me something different. This is telling me that the real test is whether you love one another. We have influences out here that are causing us to divide. They're causing us to hate our brothers, even within the church, over politics, over deceptions, over manipulations. But the real test of whether we belong to God is if we love one another. Verse 20, if someone says, I love God and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. My challenge to all of us today. And I strongly believe in the they give Stephen Covey the principle for it, the credit for Inside Out, but I think Jesus gave us the principle Inside Out when he talked about the Pharisees, you know, worrying about all these little things, worrying about what the outside is, but inside, you know, you got problems. So my challenge to us is Inside Out. Starting right here. Gotta love me. If we've been joined in marriage, we gotta love our spouse. If we're a part of this body that meets here to worship and to serve, we gotta love each other. And then as we do that, as we're joined in love and taking care of one another, which is, I am so thoroughly impressed with how we are consistently doing that. We love one another here. And we prove it every day, every week, in the things that we do and go out of our way for each other. Now we have to take that out into the community. We have to take that out to the world each one of us individually and as a congregation to continue to let that love spread. So I know that I've touched on some controversial things. Some of the hottest buttons we have in society. I hope that number one, that everything has been founded in truth. John, I believe your prayer is answered. Because I don't believe the prayer of a righteous man will return void. So here we go. Let's love each other. Let's love everybody else. Let's love the stranger. Let's love our spouse. Let's love our brothers and sisters. Let's love our children, because God is love, as we stand.